Blog Talk Radio.
And I just wanted to ask you, what are your hopes for Obama?
we hope that Obama will be able to do just what he set out to do and to make a change.
Is it going to change for the better or change for the worse?
Oh, it's definitely going to be a change for the better. If you just look out and see all the people that are here together as one in unity and harmony, I mean, yes.
Progress.
Oh, yeah, right.
Bringing this whole war to an end.
Yeah, let's stop the wars. Yeah. Is he just saying that, or is he going
to
do that?
Though, brother. He wants to put more troops in the
I take him at his word. No reason to think that the president wouldn't follow through his words.
Yes, I like him. I support him. And basically because he's bringing change, I think America needs to go in a new direction. I think he's going to lead us into a new direction.
You guys think Barack Obama's going to change things?
Well, of course he's going to change things.
Of course. With all due respect, he said he's going to stop spying on American citizens. He said he's going to uphold the Constitution. He said he's going to stop torturing. You look at his records in the Senate. He voted for the FISA bills, allowing American government to spy on American citizens warrantlessly. He voted for the Patriot Act extension. He voted to keep Guantanamo Bay alive. My main problem is everybody thinking he's a pro-peace guy. He's a guy who's going to stop spying on American citizens. He's a guy who's going to help the Bill of Rights and make everything right. But in reality, some of his policies are the same as George W. Bush.
Okay, well, I don't know that, but I believe in him, and I know he's going to do what is best for us.
Hey, be careful. A lot of people believed in George W. Bush after 9/11, and we saw what happened.
Oh, my goodness. I believe in Barack.
All right, girl.
Oh, he's my man.
All right.
And he's all of us, man. So I believe in him.
All right. Thank you for your interview.
Good Lord bless you and keep all of us well in this country.
Bless you and keep us safe from this tyrannical police state government that is ruining all ours every day.
He is the president. He basically refines American foreign policy. He accentuates American foreign policy. What you're going to see now is going to be totally different from Barack Obama, the senator. In a lot of respects, not in every respect, especially in respect in terms of how Snow, in terms of the Bush administration. So that's going to be different, all right?
If I can just throw out some facts for you, I know Obama, I've been covering his events for about 2 years now. As soon as he started running for president, he started making a lot of promises, and one of it was that we're going to stop spying on American citizens. But are you aware that his Senate record, he actually voted for FISA bills, allowing the U.S. government to spy on American citizens warrantlessly? Are you aware that he voted for the Patriot Act extension? I mean, how do you feel as a supporter of Barack Obama, his stance on those issues and his public appearance on those issues? He says one thing but votes another way.
I don't know enough to say about the details of it to make a good reply to you, but I think the integrity that the man has, and I'd have to really research the statistics to make sure that, you know, that those are accurate.
Yeah.
I just think that he is true in what he's saying and sincere and really wanting to help the middle class and just the country overall.
But you aren't critical, at least a little bit, of Obama? He did support, you know, bills in Senate when he was a senator to spy on American citizens warrantlessly, Patriot Act extension. He voted for the bailout bill, giving our tax dollar money to the bankers. They took that money and ran with it, and now it's $8.5 trillion. Are you aware of that? $8.5 trillion that Barack Obama helped pass in the Senate, the banker's bailout bill.
I am aware of that, but, you know, in life and when you are dealing with politics, there are some things that you have to do where, you know, you don't realize what the mistake will be or what the results will be from decisions that you make. And, I mean, he's here, and maybe, you know, even though he did sign that bill in the past, he learned from his mistakes.
Yeah, people really wanted to believe in him.
Everybody did, and it turned out to be not much. Like this, Martin Luther King says, I had a dream, and he says, I have a drone. So it comes down to how sad it is.
Well, people want to believe that somebody's truthful and is a man of their word, and just, it's really disappointing when it doesn't happen. Americans want to believe in their president, but sometimes they don't see what's right in front of their face.
That's true.
When you want something so badly, you don't really see what the truth is. And let's face it, I think you said today, or someone said, if Martin Luther King were alive today, he'd be in Guantanamo.
I quoted that as from something that I saw on Facebook today, or yesterday. Cornel West said that. He's a black actor.
Well, was King's Day? I was furious.
It didn't really say that. It just that it you know, he's just saying that
Martin Luther King has been forgotten. He was absorbed by Obama.
That's right.
I mean, that really bothered me. The reason we had that holiday was was named after him because you want to remember what his message was. And now his message has been diluted and has disappeared.
I agree. I wrote an article of Obama borrows.
I mean, he was a pacifist.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King was a pacifist. He would never support someone like Obama. Never.
For them to replace him
that's
on
just,
his day was just, I thought it was just...
That really just disturbed me terribly. It didn't seem like anybody else was upset about it except me.
Yeah, well, I was too.
Well, not till I mentioned it to you. You didn't really think about it.
No, I was. I didn't understand why they did it. I thought, you know, until I realized that they actually were nominating, he actually had to be on the 20th.
Well, my feeling was that they wanted to dilute Martin Luther King's real message.
Of course they do. They don't want pacifist methods or peace methods or anything like that. Obama is not a peaceful guy. He never has been.
No, he's voted and supported war and rendition and everything.
Yeah, but see, that's what bothers me so much is to see this. I just get really, really blown away when I see how opposite he is. But you can see that you can understand why they're doing that. You can understand why they want us to forget Martin Luther King's message. And everybody, they don't care. I mean, you get these idiots who just out there, Obama, 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 you know.
Well,
Obama, Obama.
Just because he's black doesn't mean he's anything like Martin Luther King.
No.
But most people seem to think that he is.
Colin Powell, Martin Luther, it was Herman McCain.
Or Condoleezza Rice, did she have any of Martin Luther King's values? No.
How about Herman Cain?
No, I don't think so.
Like, Lord, I don't know. These things were all just because...
Or just because I'm white, does that make me like George Bush?
No.
Or like John Kerry? Or like Hillary Clinton? I don't think so.
No, I just think it's...
But I haven't heard anybody speak out. I was furious. But I must be in the minority.
Possibly.
Maybe.
Possibly.
When I mentioned it to somebody at the Y when I was exercising, they hadn't really thought about it. And they didn't really watch the speech or anything. I was surprised. I rushed home so I could listen to it.
You'd think you'd have, you know, you'd think yesterday was all about it. Nobody cared. No.
I'd like to read there's a good article on this site on HARP.
Yes, I would.
Go right back to that.
Here it was.
Yeah. Sudden.
Well, I'll go right to it. Excuse me.
I don't know whether this is the one. This is on the BBC now, but you could read this anyway.
Well, they're talking about the HARP program on this.
Mm-hmm.
It says, snow chill has arrived across the UK with the fun and chaos which that entails. Much of it, many of us are being impacted by the wintry weather this week. A shock for many after such a benign start to the season. Yet the beginnings of this change and the weather can be traced back to strange goings-on miles above us in the atmosphere many days ago. For a few weeks now, forecasters have been monitoring an abrupt jump in temperatures way up in the stratosphere, not a cooling, but actually a sudden warming. And such sudden stratospheric warmings have led to notable cold spells in recent years. In January 2009, forecasters saw such an event coming down the tracks. In early February, most of the United Kingdom was under a blanket of snow. Not every southwest event leads to a bitter spell for us.
Sudden stratospheric warming event.
Oh.
Sudden stratospheric warming event leads to a bitter spell for us in the UK. And not every cold spell is caused by a sudden stratospheric warming. The atmosphere is far more complicated than that, but SSW is a powerful tool for forecasters, and at the end of the last week, it became clear that this particular SSW, sudden stratospheric warming, would have a big impact on our weather. Indeed, further snowfall is anticipated across the UK in the next few days. A difficult outlook. So the cold and snowy weather is with us, but how long will its magic and mayhem last? The honest answer is we do not know. SSW events not only throw the atmosphere into disarray, they also present huge challenges for computer models in predicting what happens next. Normally, we can be quite confident in our predictions for up to a week ahead, but not at the moment. The graphic on the right, well, it just, you know. As we run the computer predictions forward over a few days, we can see that the cold and warm boundaries remain clearly defined. The UK remains very much in the cold. However, as we look further ahead, just 4 or 5 days, the boundary becomes increasingly blurred, and within a week, the computer prediction is completely disordered. It may stay cold, it may get warmer. We do not know. In fact, anyone who tells you definitively what next week's weather will be is likely whistling in the wind. Meteorologists call this the spaghetti plot, and you can see why. So forecasters are facing a huge challenge until the effects of this sudden stratospheric warming, the SSW, wear off. Predictably, beyond just a few days, is unusually low. What we can say is that for the foreseeable future, we will remain in the grip of cold weather, and we must enjoy or endure as best we can. That's for the
That's for the UK, but that's happening here,
yeah.
Across the country right now. Cold weather.
Well, I'd like to go to the. You're on the second page of this site. On the first page, it had a. It had an article all about HARP.
This is the first page. This is the 22nd.
That wasn't the page that I was on. I didn't have any of those articles. But interesting, we'll find it. But let's go back to the cell phone. Is it stealing your energy? That's a good thing to look at. Because cell phones can be quite dangerous. Is your cell phone stealing your life force? Your life force is your energy and often referred to as your prana or life force. There are many names for it and is absolutely essential to life. Many people don't believe in energy because they can't see it or touch it. Interestingly, though, most everyone feels energy, even if they're not recognizing it for what it is. It's easy to explain off those feelings as one thing or another, but make no mistake about it, energy is all around us. If it weren't, then you and I wouldn't be here. Most people believe that life is nourished and sustained by other physical objects, such as food. Yet this is not actually how life maintains itself. Energy is the substance that sustains life. Vitamins, minerals, amino acids, proteins, do not sustain life. It is the energy inside of these substances that enables life to exist here. Our bodies are, in essence, biological machines which run on energy, not dirt. Without energy, there is no life. Do the rest of this article. It takes a minute for it to come up. This is from Waking Times. That's a site I never heard of.
Here we go.
We have to go up a little bit. Okay. Energy is flowing and moving around us all the time. If it were not so, we would not be alive. As a conscious, energetic being, you have a unique way of interacting with energy, and your mind consciously controls your energy. When your mind is placed on things outside of you, like objects, ideas, events, or people, then your energy leaves your body and follows your thoughts. Conversely, When your mind focuses on your body, you attract and deepen your energy, your life force, within your physical structure. This is the essence of many energetic physical arts, such as the practice of, I'm not sure how you pronounce
Qigong.
It. Qigong. No, that's it.
Qigong.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What does all this have to do with your cell phone? In the TED video below, Ms. Case suggests that the contents of your cell phone and your computer are actually extensions of your mind. I would agree with her somewhat, for as I have mentioned above, where your mind goes, your energy flows. When you call someone on your phone and your mind travels and connects with that person, if your mind drives your energy and your cell phone puts your mind on objects outside of your physical body, then is your cell phone stealing your energy? In a sense, yes. Especially so if you become obsessed with these devices and your need to feel connected to them grows out of proportion. Under this principle, it's quite possible you are giving your energy away with these devices when you could be holding on to it. Cell phones are neither bad nor evil, as they are very useful devices. They simply ought to be used correctly, or more specifically, you need to be conscious of how your mind thinks of them and their contents. Understanding the relationship between your thoughts and your energy is important if you want to keep your mechanical devices and other parts of your life in balance. Maintaining balance is very important for many things in life, especially for your health and happiness. When your relationship to objects that are supposed to make your life better becomes out of balance, you can experience a disturbance in your emotional state, your mental state, and your physical state. Yeah, it's called an addiction. The most important thing to remember is that you are the director of your thoughts and your life force. Once you have an understanding of how important your energy is and basic understanding of how it works to your benefit and to your detriment, that it's much easier to place the correct amount of emphasis on the devices that you use in your daily life. Let's see. We are all cyborgs now.
Yeah, I don't know if we haven't.
Yeah, let's see if this. What this.
These are all kids, teenagers and stuff.
They're all gathered around these cell phones.
I would like to tell you all that you are all actually cyborgs, but not the cyborgs that you think. You're not RoboCop and you're not Terminator, but you're cyborgs every time you look at a computer screen or use one of your cell phone devices. So what's a good definition for cyborg? Well, a traditional definition is an organism to which exogenous components have been added for the purpose of adapting to new environments. That came from a 1960 paper on space travel, because if you think about it, space is pretty awkward. People aren't supposed to be there. But humans are curious, and they like to add things to their bodies so that they can go to the Alps one day and then become a fish in the sea the next. So let's look at the concept of traditional anthropology. Somebody goes to another country, says how fascinating these people are, how interesting their tools are, how curious their culture is, and then they write a paper and maybe a few other anthropologists read it and we think it's very exotic. Well, what's happening is that we've suddenly found a new species. I, as a cyborg anthropologist, have suddenly said, oh, wow, now suddenly we're a new form of Homo sapiens, and look at these fascinating cultures, and look at these curious rituals that everybody is doing around this technology. They're clicking on things and staring at screens. Now, there's a reason why I study this versus traditional anthropology, and the reason is that tool use, in the beginning for thousands and thousands of years, everything has been a physical modification of self. It has helped us to extend our physical self, go faster, hit things harder, and there's been a limit on that. But now what we're looking at is not an extension of the physical self, but an extension of the mental self. And because of that, we're able to travel faster, communicate differently. And the other thing that happens is that we're all carrying around little Mary Poppins technology. We can put anything we want into it, and it doesn't get heavier, and then we can take anything out. What does the inside of your computer actually look like? Well, if you print it out, it looks like 1,000 pounds of material that you're carrying around all the time. And if you actually lose that information, it means that you suddenly have this loss. in your mind, that you suddenly feel like something's missing, except you aren't able to see it, so it feels like a very strange emotion. The other thing that happens is that you have a second self. Whether you like it or not, you're starting to show up online, and people are interacting with your second self when you're not there. And so you have to be careful about, you know, leaving your front lawn open, which is basically your Facebook wall, so that, you know, people don't write on it in the middle of the night, because it's very much the equivalent. And suddenly we have to start to maintain our second self. You have to present yourself in digital life in a similar way that you would in your analog life. So in the same way that you wake up, take a shower, and get dressed, you have to learn to do that for your digital self. And the problem is that a lot of people now, especially adolescents, have to go through two adolescencies. They have to go through their primary one that's already awkward, and then they have to go through their second self adolescence. And that's even more awkward because there's an actual kind of history of what they've gone through online. And anybody coming in new to technology is an adolescent online right now. And so it's very awkward, and they, you know, it's very difficult for them to do those things. So when I was little, my dad would sit me down at night, and he would say, I'm going to teach you about time and space in the future. And I said, great. And he said one day, what's the shortest distance between two points? And I said, well, that's a straight line. You told me that yesterday. I thought it was very clever. He said, no, no, no. Here's a better way. He took a piece of paper, drew A and B on one side and the other, and folded them together to where A and B touched. And he said, that is the shortest distance between two points. And I said, Dad, how do you do that? He said, well, you just spend time in space. It takes an awful lot of energy, and that's just how you do it. And I said, I want to do that. And he said, well, okay. And so when I went to sleep for the next, you know, 10 or 20 years, I was thinking at night, I want to be the first person to create a wormhole, to make things accelerate faster, and I want to make a time machine. I was always sending messages to my future self and using tape recorders. But then what I realized when I went to college is that technology doesn't just get adopted because it works. It gets adopted because people use it, and it's made for humans. So I started studying anthropology. And when I was writing my thesis on cell phones, I realized that everyone was carrying around wormholes in their pocket. They weren't physically transporting themselves. They were mentally transporting themselves. They would click on a button, and they would be connected as A to B immediately. And I thought, oh, wow, I found it. This is great. So over time, time and space have compressed because of this. You can stand on one side of the world, whisper something, and be heard on the other. One of the other ideas that comes around is that you have a different type of time on every single device that you use. Every single browser tab gives you a different type of time. And because of that, you start to dig around for your external memories. Where did you leave them? So now we're all these paleontologists that are digging for things that we've lost on our external brains that we're carrying around in our pockets. And that incites a sort of panic architecture. Oh, no, where's this thing? It's coming in. We're all Isle of Lucy on a great assembly line of information, and we can't keep up. And so what happens is when we bring all of that into the social space, we end up checking our phones all the time. So we have this sort of thing called ambient intimacy. It's not that we're always connected to everybody, but at any time we can connect to anyone we want. And if you were able to print out everybody in your cell phone, the room would be very crowded. These are all the people that you have access to right now. In general, all of these people, all your friends and family that you can connect to. And so there are some psychological effects that happen with this. What I'm really worried about is that people aren't taking time for mental reflection anymore, and that they aren't slowing down and stopping being around all those people in the room all the time that are trying to compete for their attention on the simultaneous time interfaces, paleontology, and panic architecture. They're not just sitting there. And really, when you have no external input, that is the time when there's a creation of self, when you can do long-term planning, when you can try and figure out who you really are. And then once you do that, you can figure out how to present your second self in a legitimate way instead of just dealing with everything as it comes in and, oh, I have to do this, and I have to do this, and I have to do this. And so this is very important. I'm really worried that especially kids today, they're not going to be dealing with this downtime, that they have an instantaneous button-clicking culture and that everything comes to them and that they become very excited about it and very addicted to it. So if you think about it, the world hasn't stopped either. It has its own external prosthetic devices, and these devices are helping us all to communicate and interact with each other. But when you actually visualize it, all the connections that we're doing right now, this is an image of the mapping of the internet, it doesn't look technological. It actually looks very organic. This is the first time in the entire history of humanity that we've connected in this way. And it's not that machines are taking over. It's that they're helping us to be more human, helping us to connect with each other. The most successful technology gets out of the way and helps us live our lives. And really, it ends up being more humans than technology because we're co-creating each other all the time. And so this is the important point that I like to study. Things are beautiful, that it's still human connection. It's just done in a different way. We're just increasing our humanness and our ability to connect with each other, regardless of geography. So that's why I study cyborg anthropology. Thank you.
Kind of a fascinating thing. I don't know who she was.
Didn't say. Tim Crisco.
That's the author of
That's not the.
That wasn't the woman who spoke, but she was quite fascinating, I thought. But anyway.
You go to Waking Times. You can check that out.
Is your cell phone stealing your life force?
I think it is. A lot of kids, the people I see on them all 24 hours a day, yeah. I think so.
But she said it's increasing our humanness if you use it as a tool.
Yeah. Strange. Anyway.
That's her way of looking at it.
UN's global mercury ban exempts vaccines. That's kind of weird. Oh, I heard this because it, you know. I mean, they want to ban mercury and everything, but they won't take it out of vaccinations. Strange. Maybe for your thoughts. Truth exists. What's that? Truth exists, only lies are invented. Okay. UN global mercury ban exempts vaccines. Mercury, the deadly poison. Just the tiniest drop will contaminate everything, land, air, water, and people. It attacks the central nervous system and is particularly harmful to children, except when it is contained in vaccines. Then it is perfectly acceptable, because apparently direct injection of mercury into a living being with a central nervous system and a brain is not harmful, according to the UN. The World Health Organization clearly caters to the big pharma cartel.
Treaty on mercury would not affect vaccines with mercury, thermosol. The treaty says that certain mercury-added products, such as batteries, lamps, switches, skin lightening cosmetics, pesticides, and thermometers, may not be manufactured, imported, exported no later than 2020. Mercury-added dental amalgams are also to be phased out. No mercury in cosmetics, pesticides, thermometers, and dental amalgams, but certain mercury-added products are to be exempted from the ban, including those used for military and civil protection. Products with no mercury-free alternative, products used in religion or traditional practices, I don't know what religion uses mercury, and vaccines containing thermosil and ethyl mercury preservative. The omission of thermosil-containing vaccines from the ban disappointed advocates who believe the preservative plays a role in sickening some children. Children's health took a backseat to special interests, pharmaceutical profits. The only major purposeful exposure to mercury that didn't get addressed was thermosil. There you have it, folks. Mercury bad, except in a vaccine injected directly into living tissue with direct access to the nervous system and the brain. Yeah.
Do you know what's happening there, folks? Genocide, eugenics. Oh, boy. The leader, the leading pack is the UN for eugenics.
Well, go back up for a minute. There was something I wanted to go. Was Aaron Schwartz killed by an MIT satanic child porn ring? That's really weird.
His involvement in everything was, this guy was, it's a long involved story about a guy who was an activist.
And what happened to him? It's kind of confusing.
Well, the story's confusing. This guy was into everything and his brother, all right? It sounds like they finally stepped on too many toes.
Mm.
I mean, we can read it. leave, and where it happened in the United States, I guess.
This is from rents.com.
Yeah.
And it's by...
pretty long.
Yeah.
Very long. Actually, it's too long.
Yeah.
It's
well,
really... It's really
people can go to this article on rents.com.
It's really,
by...
Yeah, it's really convoluted, too.
It's by Yoshi Shimaatsu. And was Aaron Schwartz killed by an MIT satanic child porn ring? I mean, I don't know whether they can prove it, but...
Well, the whole thing, you know, I don't even want to get into this, because I think it just, you know, it's more crap that we have to try to explain. And so, you know.
If you're interested in it, you can go to rents.com and read that.
Yeah,
it would take a while to read that article.
There have been articles on this guy, but he was into so many things that, and then he tried to expose everything. Lots of problems there.
Mm-hmm.
So, hang on a second.
Charlie Sheen.
It was, yeah. Oh, yeah, this is, I want to read a little more on vaccines because everybody's, you know, they're pushing them like crazy right now, especially in this country.
Well, it's a flu scare.
But, you know, but if you listen to what actually is there, Natural News will tell you.
I'm not sure you'd want to take it.
I don't think you want to take it. Okay. New world vaccine
to make up your own,
striking,
right?
Across America. Natural News. It is obvious nowadays by watching, listening, or reading mainstream media news that there is a plan, a goal to get as many people vaccinated as possible. The flu vaccine, one of the biggest hoaxes pounded into people's brains, is not just a choice anymore for uninformed victims. It's becoming a mandate in some places. Hospitals across America are beginning to implement flu vaccine mandates, forcing their staff to comply or lose their job. Some are bending to this new world vaccine order. Some are not. 7 nurses terminated for not complying.
In the case of Joyce Ginrich, an oncology nurse at IU Health Goshen Hospital, mandates were in place. She was given 2 options, flu shot or no job. She refused the injection and went on to say, "I knew that I could not compromise my personal belief system for a job," explained Ginrich, who had worked at the hospital off and on since 1987. "It was really sad to leave that job. In all my years of nursing, it was my favorite." Along with 7 others at the hospital, she was terminated for not complying. She continued, "I feel like my personal faith, I feel like in my personal faith walk, I'm not instructed to get a flu vaccination, but it's also the whole matter of the right to choose what I put in my body, what I feel God wants need to put in versus someone mandating what I put in. It's a very big issue for me." Fellow nurses at the U Health Goshen Hospital, Ethel Hoover, resisted the mandate as well. "The last time Hoover had a flu shot was about 20 years ago. Hoover said she got sick from it and decided to never again take one, adding she was also worried about the long-term health effects from the vaccination.
Attack on personal liberty in the name of safety. In Waterbury, Connecticut, at the Waterbury Hospital, Dr. Stephen Aronin, chief of infectious diseases section, dictates, "It's to protect the public, protect our patients, but at the same time, it's to protect our healthcare workers, too." This has led staff member Pam Curley to speak out. She states, "I'm more than willing to wear a mask. I'm more than willing to take other measures. I just prefer to not be injected with a substance I'm not prepared for. There's risk of death with the flu shot. I will probably lose my job because I'm not going to get the flu shot. It's not worth it to me."
Is it worth it?
Yeah, is it worth it to me? To me, it's bigger than Waterbury Hospital. It's bigger than me. It's what our country is founded on. It's about freedom. Patriots such as her are not alone. America is under continuous threat of oppressions from tyrants imposing their new world order.
Like some sort of
propaganda tyranny.
Like some sort of genocide, these toxic flu vaccines are being injected into the population as the propaganda machine continues to hardwire eyes and brains. Known poisons in a typical flu vaccine include
mercury, aluminum, a neurotoxin has been linked to Alzheimer's disease, phenol or carbolic acid, beta propylalactone disinfectant, ethylene glycol antifreeze. This is in the vaccines. Triton X100, a detergent. Sodium phosphate. Oxytocinol 9, a vaginal spermicide. My God.
Huh.
And non-oxynol, used to kill or stop growth of STDs. So this is all in vaccines. This is really, really, this is a typical...
No, in a
typical
flu vaccine. Known reactions to the flu shots include life-threatening allergies to various ingredients, Guillain-Barré syndrome, a severe paralytic disease, encephalitis, that's brain inflammation, neurological disorders, thrombocytopenia, a serious blood disorder.
Wow.
Lance Johnson is the author, and along with his wife, Kinder, are creating natural product movements from the ground up.
And you can go to allnaturalfreespirit.com and check them out. But that's really frightening, huh?
Sure is.
That's this vaccination.
Very scary.
The flu vaccine is revealed as the greatest quackery ever pushed in the history of medicine. Let's check this one out.
Check that out. Prepare to have your world rocked. What you're about to read here will leave you astonished, inspired, outraged, all at the same time. You're about to be treated to some little-known information demonstrating why seasonal flu vaccines are utterly worthless and why their continued promotion is based entirely on fabricated studies and medical mythology. The whole world knew what you're about to read here. If the whole world knew what you're about to read here, or hear here, the vaccine industry would collapse overnight. The information comes to you courtesy of a brilliant article published in The Atlantic in November of 2009. The article written by Shannon Brownlee and Jean Lenzer isn't just brilliant, in my opinion. It stands as the best article on the flu vaccines that have ever been published in the popular press. Entitled, Does the Vaccine Matter? It presents some of the most eye-opening material you've probably ever read about the failure of flu vaccines. And it says...
You can read the full article here. But perhaps its impressive narrative shouldn't be too surprising. Though since writer Shannon Brownlee is also the celebrated author of a phenomenal book on modern medicine called Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. And while I've never done this before, I'm going to summarize this article point by point, along with some comments, so that you get the full force of what's finally been put into print. This information is so important that I encourage you to share the following summary I put together. Email it to family, friends, and coworkers, or post it on your blog or website, with a link and proper credit to both Natural News and The Atlantic, please. And get this information to the world. People need to know this, and so far the mainstream media has utterly failed to make this information known. It begins after around a dozen bullets.
Okay, does the vaccine matter? What follows is a point-by-point summary of this groundbreaking article. My opinion statements are shown in brackets and italics. The first bullet, vaccination is the core strategy of the U.S. government's plan to combat the swine flu.
The U.S. government has spent roughly $3 billion stockpiling vaccines and antiviral drugs.
The CDC, that's the Center for Disease Control, is recommending that 159 million Americans receive a swine flu vaccine injection as soon as possible.
What if vaccines don't work? More and more researchers are skeptical about whether they do.
Seasonal flu, That's the regular food. Currently kills an estimated 36,000 people each year in the United States. But most people who die are already suffering from existing diseases such as asthma.
Most colds aren't really caused by the flu virus, as few as 7 or 8%, and at most 50% of colds have an influenza origin. They are more than 200 viruses and pathogens that can cause influenza-like illnesses, and therefore we easily mistake it for the flu.
Viruses mutate with amazing speed, meaning that each year's circulating influenza is genetically different from the previous year.
The vaccine for each upcoming flu season is formulated by health experts taking a guess, a wild guess at times, about what strain of influenza might be most likely to circulate in the future.
The 1918 Spanish flu infected roughly one-third of the world's population and killed at least 40 million people.
In the U.S., the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology predicated that H1N1... H1N1 influenza would infect up to one-half the U.S. population and kill 90,000 Americans.
Of those who have died from the swine flu in the U.S., roughly 70% were already diseased with some serious underlying conditions such as asthma or AIDS.
And public health officials consider vaccines to be their first and best weapon against influenza. Well, vaccines helped eradicate smallpox and polio. I don't agree with that assessment. Vaccines did relatively little to compare to improvements in public sanitation.
So he feels that public sanitation didn't help.
Yeah, that's been noted for many, many years.
Each year, 100 million Americans get vaccinated, and vaccines remain a staple of public health policy in the United States. Why the research is bogus? Because researchers can't exactly pin down who has influenza and who doesn't. The research conducted on the effectiveness of vaccines simply calculates the death rate from all causes among those who take the vaccine versus those who don't. This includes deaths from accidents, heart attacks, medications, car wrecks, everything.
These studies show a dramatic difference between the death rate of those who get the vaccine versus those who don't. People who get vaccinated have significantly lower death rates from all causes, and herein lies the problem. Flu shot propaganda cites these studies, telling people that if they get their flu shots every year, they will have a significantly reduced chance of dying. This is extremely misleading.
Critics question the logic of these studies. As it turns out, compared to the number of deaths from all causes, the number of people killed by influenza is quite small. According to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, deaths from influenza account for at most 10% of the total deaths during the flu season, and this includes all indirect deaths aggravated by the flu.
This brings up a hugely important dilemma. If influenza only accounts for roughly 10% of all deaths during the flu season, how could any influenza vaccine reduce total deaths by 50%? As is claimed by the vaccine manufacturer, it doesn't add up. Even if the vaccines were 100% effective, they should only reduce the total death rate by 10%, given that only 10% of the total deaths are caused by influenza.
Here's a direct quote from the story. Tom Jefferson, a physician based in Rome and the head of the vaccine field at the Cochrane Collaboration, a highly respected international network of researchers who appraised medical evidence, says, for a vaccine to reduce mortality by 50% and up to 90% in some studies means it has to prevent death, not just from influenza, but also from falls, fires, heart disease, strokes, and car accidents. That's not a vaccine. That's a miracle.
And the failure of cohort studies. So how do the vaccines compare... companies come up with this 50% reduction of death rate statistic through cohort studies.
Cohort studies compare the death rates of large groups of people who received the vaccine to large groups of people who did not receive the vaccine. But there's a fatal flaw in this approach. people self-select for vaccinations. And what kind of people, as it turns out, people who take more precautions with their health?
Thus, you automatically have a situation where the more health-cautious people are getting the vaccine because they think it's good for them. Meanwhile, all the masses of people who don't give a damn about their health tend to skip the seasonal flu vaccine. And these people tend to not take very good health care, good care of their health in lots of other ways. In other words, in terms of the masses, people who get vaccines are more likely to avoid junk food and live a more health-cautious lifestyle. This explains the differences in the death rates between the two groups. It has nothing to do with a vaccine.
There is an extreme cult-like peer pressure put on doctors and researchers to swallow the vaccine mythology without question. Quoted from the story, Lisa Jackson, a physician and senior investigator with the Group Health Research Center in Seattle, began wondering aloud to colleagues if maybe something was amiss with the estimate of 50% mortality reduction for people who get flu vaccine. The response she got sounded more like doctrine than science. People told me, no good can come from asking this, she says. Potentially a lot of bad could happen for me professionally by raising any criticism that might dissuade people from getting vaccinated because, of course, we know that vaccine works. This was the prevailing wisdom. In other words, don't dare question the vaccine. Don't ask tough scientific questions because the vaccine,
industry
runs on dogma, not science. And if you ask any questions, you might find yourself out of a job. Here's where the really good part begins.
Lisa Jackson was not deterred. She and three other researchers began to study the widely quoted vaccine statistics in an attempt to identify this healthy user effect, if any. They looked through 8 years of medical data covering 72,000 people aged 65 or older and recorded who received flu shots and who didn't. Then they compared the death rate for all causes outside the flu season. The vaccine made no difference in mortality.
What she found blows a hole right through the vaccination industry. She found that even outside the flu season, the death rate was 60% higher among those who did not get vaccines than among those who, in other words, even when you take the flu season completely out of the equation, elderly people who didn't get vaccines have other lifestyle factors that make them far more likely to die from lots of other causes.
She also found that this so-called healthier user effect explains the entire apparent benefit that continues to be attributed to vaccines. This finding demonstrates that the flu vaccine may not have any beneficial effect whatsoever in reducing mortality. How well done were these particular studies? Quoted from the story, Jackson papers are beautiful, said Lauren Simonson, who is a professional of global health at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and an internationally recognized expert in influenza and vaccine
epidemiology.
There's no P in there. It says epidemiology.
Yeah, it's a studying.
You're putting an extra P in
there. Oh, sorry.
It's not extra epidemiology. It's epidemiology. Epidemiology. Yeah.
Got it?
I think so. They are classic studies in epidemiology. They are so carefully done.
Many pro-vaccine experts simply refuse to believe the results of this study because it conflicts with their existing beliefs in the vaccine mythology. The Journal of the American Medical Association refused to publish her research, even stating, to accept these results would be to say that the earth is flat, which just goes to show you how deeply ingrained the current vaccine mythology is in the minds of conventional medical practitioners. They simply cannot imagine that vaccines don't work, so they dismiss any evidence, even good evidence, demonstrating that fact. That is what makes the vaccine industry a cult rather than a science. Jackson's papers were finally published in 2006 in the International Journal of Epidemiology.
Yes.
We got it.
Here's a really, really juicy part we can't miss. Vaccine storage proves it never worked in the first place. The history of flu vaccines reveals some huge gaps in current vaccination mythology, especially proven they don't work. For example, in 2004, vaccine production was low and there was a shortage in vaccines, a 40% reduction.
I remember that.
And yet mortality rates did not rise during the flu season. Clearly, if vaccines actually worked, in a year when the vaccine wasn't even administered to 40% of the people who normally get it, would have resulted in a huge and statistically significant increase in mortality. It should have spiked the death rate and filled the morgues, but it didn't. You know why? Because flu vaccines don't work in the first place.
That was the last year. The year before that, I refused to get any vaccines.
I haven't had any since the 90s.
Because I said, this is ridiculous. They have a shortage in vaccines, and people are just as healthy now as they were before.
Well, I kind of go by the same thing, that where people who did get it got the flu right after they got the shot. And from then on, they said they wouldn't take it again, and that happened to me over 15 years ago.
I've talked to a couple of people who said that, too.
Yeah.
In the history of flu vaccines, there were 2 years in which the formulated flu vaccine was a total mismatch to the widely circulating influenza that made people sick. These years were 1968 and 1997. In both of those years, the vaccine was completely mismatched for the circulating virus. In effect, nobody was vaccinated.
Knowing this, if the vaccine itself was effective at reducing death rates, then we should have once again seen a huge spike in death rates during these two years, right? Well, seriously, if the vaccine reduced death rates by 50%, as is claimed by vaccine manufacturers, then these 2 years in which the vaccine completely missed the mark should have seen huge spikes in the winter death rates, right? But what really happened was nothing. Not a blip, not a spike, nothing. The death rate didn't rise at all.
If vaccines really worked to save lives, then the more people you vaccinate, the lower the death rates you should see, right? But that's not the case. Back in 1989, only 15% of over 65 people got vaccinated against the flu. But today, thanks to the big vaccine push, over 65% are vaccinated. And yet, amazingly, death rates among the elderly have not gone down during the flu season. In fact, they've gone up.
Yeah. But vaccine promoters and CDC officials were challenged about the 50% mortality reduction myth. They invoked dogmatic language and attacked the messenger. They are simply not willing to consider the possibility that flu vaccines simply don't work. Scientists who question the vaccine mythology are routinely shunned by the medical establishment. Tom Jefferson from the Cochrane Collaboration is an epidemiologist who questions the claimed benefits of flu vaccines. The reaction against Jefferson has been so dogmatic and even hysterical that you'd think he was advocating stealing babies.
Jefferson is one of the world's best informed researchers on flu vaccine. He leads a team of researchers who have examined hundreds of vaccine studies. To quote directly from the article, the vast majority of studies were deeply flawed, says Jefferson. Rubbish is not a scientific term, but I think that term applies to these studies.
Flu vaccines only work on people who don't need them. And this article goes on quite a ways further, but I don't know if you want to finish it.
No, we're right at 9 o'clock anyway.
But I suggest you go to it and read more of it.
So you don't have to panic if you don't have a flu vaccination?
It's not going to make any difference. And please don't put your kids through that, through mercury contamination. Oh, my God. And anyway, naturalnews.com. Check out that site. It's one of the best.
Yep.
And
good night, folks.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun. And join us tomorrow night when we have more news and views. Good night,
and
everyone.
Have a good evening.